Hey everyone, Susan here. I am so excited for you to hear this episode. Regardless of if you've got a company going, if you're thinking of a company, this episode is hopefully going to blow your mind as much as it's blowing my mind still right now. So my guest today is the founder of Fundify, Josh Chadnowitz. And previously his brainchild was art.com. That company was sold for an undisclosed amount to Walmart when it was doing $300 million a year. In this episode, we are going to talk about how Fundify is about to change the landscape of startup investing, where previously one had to be wealthy, you had to be a qualified investor, and they are about to totally dismantle that, disrupt it, and you will hear how, which is so freaking cool. So get ready for this episode. It's absolutely, absolutely amazing. And before we jump into the episode, a couple of quick announcements. Number one, I want to ask you, how's your branding going? Do you feel that you are representing well on your social media, especially on LinkedIn? Do you have your own personal website? Because if not, you need to go to agency8.com, get signed up with them. And full disclosure, I did found that agency. I no longer run it, but they are doing some absolutely incredible things. You can get your own personal branded website for about just over $2,500. You can get a LinkedIn Basics branding kit, which includes your banner. It includes a video, your description, all the really great stuff you need for LinkedIn, which is such a key platform. And you can get that for $397, but with a code RARE, R-A-R-E, you get 50% off right now. So go over to agency8.com and check it out, because it absolutely is essential that as a founder that you do invest in your brand. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. And I'm excited for you to hear my interview with Josh Chadnowitz, founder of Fundify.com. This is Ron Real Entrepreneurship, the show that brings the no-nonsense truth of what is required to start, grow, and scale your business. I am your host, Susan Sly. Well, Josh, thank you so much for being here. And you and I were chatting about all sorts of things prior to, you know, jumping into the episode. And before we get into fundraising and the startup environment, like, my burning question for you is, because as someone born in the 70s, you know, going through high school in the 80s, mm-hmm. being a young adult right there on the cusp of the dot-com boom, dude, 1994, and you so saw it, but so many people didn't. What did you see was going to happen with the internet that maybe other people didn't see?
Yeah, it was a great time. And for me, the introduction came in 94. So we saw it in 92, where colleges started using email addresses. And then in 94, where a buddy of mine who was going, ended up becoming the founder of art.com with me, he was at Virginia Tech, and they were putting in a T1 line into Virginia Tech. And he's saying, listen, this internet's going to be huge. And I'm sitting there, well, what's the internet? And what does that mean? And so that it started on an idea that just said, okay, so this technology is going to be written. What does it allow people to do? How does that work? And then starting to unravel the kind of what's next question. Well, then what will happen next? Because currently you can't even talk to each other with the computers that we have. And so what happens when the modems start working faster, and what kind of information could we pass? And then what happens, right? And then what happens? And we find myself 30 years later asking myself the same questions in the industries now, saying, well, okay, this is what's happening now, and then what will happen? And I think that's a tried and true method of figuring out and testing hypotheses around what might happen in an industry to try to predict what the future is going to hold, right? Where are we going? And how will things get there? So it came about just trying to understand the internet and seeing the evolution of technology, and then thinking through how to capitalize on that.
I love that. And then what's next? And then what's next, right? Like, just continuing to ask the question. As you were sharing that story, I remember the first time I saw email. Do you remember the first time you saw the first email you ever sent? Or
I don't remember. The first email I ever sent was what I think was back in 92 or 93. I don't remember exactly what it was. Do you remember yours?
So I was 92. I was working on a research project and we were doing crime scene quantification and building early algorithms to try and catch offenders. Wow. And so there were five universities that were involved. And so I was with the professor, the lead professor who was working on the project. And we were at a university in Ottawa. And the professor's like, "Hey, Susan, come look at this." And I'm like, "What is it?" He's like, "You know that question you just had about quantification?" I'm like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Let me ask someone in Virginia." And he starts like, you know, doing the single, those of you who are listening, like I'm doing the pretend, like the single index finger typing. And then, you know, it's like the little dots appear as like, okay. Or I'm like, okay, cool. And then the reply comes back and he's like, "Susan, this is email. And this is going to be huge. Right now, colleges use it, but everyone's going to use it." So when I first got my first email account, my first email I sent to was my dad, Joe, who I talk about all the time on the show. And so, and that was my very first email that I ever sent.
Fun. I love it. I love it. One kind of perspective looking back at what's now is what, 30 years ago. That I use in relation to internet and email is that at that time in 94, when we started ART, one out of 800 Americans had an email address, That means if you had one, you had nobody to email, right? Because no one else had one. And so the use of it was essentially kind of useless, right? Because you barely knew anyone that would use it, which meant if no one else used it, you would never check yours. So you had to kind of get by the whole idea of, hey, what if everybody started using that, right? What if everybody had an account? Would that become a way to communicate that would become huge? Of course it is, right? And it's become a massive way, just like, you know, in the last decade or two, mobile phones have become another method of communication, right? That has transformed the world we live in and has offered so much opportunity to everyone.
Thinking too about that piece around, you know, what if everyone had one? And I've interviewed now 360 founders, and this is the first ever interview those types of questions, Josh. No wonder you've been so successful. What if everyone had one? What happens next? What could happen next? The question that comes to my mind, if we were just sitting having coffee or you're in Austin, we're having my friend lives in Austin. It's like when you have tequila and club soda, they call it ranch water there. If we're having one of those. Yeah. And my question that comes to mind is there are a lot of people out there when they say what happens next, they tend to go down these negative loopholes and it's the end of humanity and they end up being paralyzed with fear. And suddenly they're ordering like all of these supplies because the world's going to come to an end. How do you keep your what happens next in a place that's more productive?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I'm not inclined to do that, right? To think of the negatives. I'm more inclined like to think about what could this be as from an opportunity perspective, because if it's the end of all humanity, well, then it's kind of what next question always leads to, well, the end of all time, right? Every single situation ends in, well, yeah, then the world is gone. Elon Musk's solution to that is, well, let's go to space, right? So he also looks at that as opportunistic, right? At the end of all time, well, let's go to Mars, right? As interplanetary sort of evolution, right? And moving into another world. It's the world reeks of opportunity left and right, and change enables that and offers that opportunity to everyone. And so I think if you're looking for an excuse where things will fail, you'll find it. If you're looking for a reason why it will work, you can find it. So either way, whatever you think, you'll be right. And so set the mindset there.
whatever you think, you'll be right. And that opportunity piece, the most successful entrepreneurs I know, they look at whatever is happening in the economy, politically, whatever, and they say, there is an opportunity here. And right now on the show, Josh, I'm interviewing so many founders who started businesses during the pandemic. Because there they were sitting there going, hey, okay, I've kind of got more time on my hands now. And I, you know, that if I suppress my entrepreneurial longings, I've got to like explode with an idea of some sort. And I predict that the next great unicorns we're hearing about and decacorns are all going to be people who were resilient enough to raise the money, get their seed capital down and so forth during that time. Before we transition, so there it is, art.com. And I one of my good friends was a co-founder at GoDaddy. Okay. And so like, you've got like all of these people buying .coms, just like they're buying .AIs. I own some .AIs because my newest venture is the pause.AI. When I went to buy it, I was like, oh my gosh, I got it. I felt like I was winning that day, Josh. Right. It was like such a dopamine hit. When you bought art.com, like what, were you buying other domains too? Like, how did you know that was the one?
Well, interestingly enough, that was already taken when we started. So we didn't we weren't always art.com. We started out, we bought it. There's a lot of things in the domain world that happened back in those days because it was early. We started our business with the name pokers.com. So poker with an S.com. Okay. Changed to allwall.com, and then eventually bought our leading competitor, which was art.com, and then changed our name that way. And interestingly enough, in the early days, my co-founder said, hey, listen, these domains are going to be worth a lot. This is like early on. We should buy a bunch of domains. And he's looking it up online. And I don't remember all of them, but it's like baseball.com is available. We should buy that. And I'm sitting in the other room saying, it's $200, I think $180 to buy a domain at that time. Now it's 10, right? Yeah. But I would sit in the other room saying, we got to focus on our business. We could have bought a domain for $200 and made a fortune just sitting on that, right? But instead, we went the route of, the hard route, I suppose, of building a business versus, buying some domains that turned out to be, very expensive, very valuable. I did buy domains over the years and have accumulated a handful of them. And, that's just the nature of, like you said, this is a really good one. Fundify. I got Fundify.com years ago and I wasn't building Fundify. I think I was traveling with our family or my wife and it was in an auction and we bought it for a few thousand dollars and thought this would be a good name. Maybe one day we'll use it. And, turns out we are now. And so it's a opportunistic sort of buying situation.
Absolutely. Like one of the ones I own is endlegalwoes.com. Okay. I am not an attorney. I'm like, but somewhere out there, and I just sit on them. Somewhere out there, there's an attorney is like, an injury attorney. They're like, I need to buy that domain. And just, like you, I own some. So we're going to shift gears. There are so many things I could ask you because anyone building in the 90s, my mind automatically goes to the 80s, but I'm going to resist the temptation except to ask you this. Did you play video games in the 80s? And if so, what was your favorite one?
So I definitely played video games in the 80s. So that was my teenage years. And I played a handful of games, but I remember getting like an Atari 2600 and
playing. Yes.
Games, right. And yes. Then I upgraded to I think it was a 72 or a 7800. And I think it was 7200 and enjoying simple games like Pac-Man, or Pitfall. There were games that really simple games back in the day. Some of them are coming back and are still, kind of interesting to see those come out. But I also enjoyed strategic type games. I remember in middle school, I started kind of engineering some like coding some basic games that you through the basic language games of like pirates and treasures and finding things. But it was all no graphical interfaces. It was more imaginative, right? We're like, okay, attack this ship. And then it would tell you, okay, you this many people died, this is what you got. And it was exciting and interesting because at that time that was brand new, right? That was very interesting and fascinating. And so, yeah, definitely played games and enjoyed that. And my kids play games now, right? That are, they're right now, they're very much into Politopia and love that and the challenge and strategic aspect of the game. And it's fun. You know, it's fun, gets our minds working.
Well, the reason I ask you that is because of all of the founders that I've had who've been in our age range, they did play video games in the 80s. And I was coding like you in BASIC, and I took Dungeons and Dragons, and I was like, oh, what if I could take it, you know, from the book and the dice, and I could make those decision trees, because like you said, we didn't have the graphical interfaces, right? So what if I could take those? And it really had an effect on how I look at technology today, because our generation was the first generation to be exposed to technology truly as young people, as children, right? So, and Gen X. So that's why I asked you that. Okay, let's fast forward time. So Fundify, let's take a look at this. Last year, 2023, was one of the worst years for fundraising of all time. One of my guests called it the year of no. I saw founders, some of the companies I've invested in, I've invested in companies where I've had the founder on the show and I'm just, you know, interview the founder, but I saw last year some of the most creative fundraising, a lot of repetitive angel rounds when they couldn't get VCs. One of my friends is a VC. He had one of his funds is 90 million. They deployed zero capital of that particular fund last year. And then Fundify is the democratization of fundraising. And when I looked at the site and I was researching you and looking at all our 62 connections on LinkedIn, I'm like, thank God. So how did the idea come into fruition?
I think the idea started as I've been making, for a decade or so, I've been making startup investments myself, like you, 60, 70, now 80 startups that we're invested in, and watching the returns of those be quite successful. Although many of them have gone completely bankrupt, right? Lost all my money in those investments, but you see the positive effect.
What percentage have gone under, and just of the ones you've invested
in? Mine, about a third already, and more to come, I'm sure. If you look at the full data, it will end up about 50 to 60% that don't return money. And then I think the data that we looked at and looking at all of it is that 93% of your investment returns come from 7% of the investments you make. And so what that leads you to is this world that says, hey, you need to invest in a lot of companies, frankly, to really find, you need to develop a method that works. But even when it works, you have to make lots of investments in order to make that happen. For me, I'm a mathematician. I love math. And so that I love statistics and things of that nature. So back 6 to 8 years ago, I started thinking through statistics that aren't so easily kind of measured or aren't easily available, because you can't find a publicly traded startup fund or an ETF, right? An index fund for startups. You can find SPY, that's an index fund for the S&P 500, but you can't buy one for early stage startup investing, let's say. And so the question then that comes to mind is, well, what are the returns of that? Everybody knows that startups are risky. And I think we all have this theory of a saying that says, well, with risk comes reward. Well, is that true? And how does that play out in a grand scheme of things? And so we gathered dozens of studies at the time. Now we have 146 studies in our database, passing over 18,000 startups inside of all those studies. And what those studies show you, that if you invested across the board, you would have made upwards of 25 to 28% annually. Those are phenomenal returns as an investor, right?
Yes.
Now, the thing that struck me here, so now at the same time, what has struck me is the fact that investments in startups are exclusively provided to accredited individuals. So what you could easily just call wealthier individuals are allowed. Venture funds are all capital are raised from qualified individuals or organizations, right? So as an average American, you cannot invest in a startup. It's actually not allowed. And nor will the startup even pay attention if you wanted to put $50 or $500 into a company. That just doesn't make sense. It won't pay for the lunch that you're having, sort of thing, right? So why would they kind of continue down that path? And then comes around the new, so if I take a step back, in the 30s, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, created some laws that protected the American public by saying, hey, listen, non-accredited individuals, meaning people that don't have a lot of wealth, we're not going to allow entrepreneurs to raise capital from them, because we don't want the entrepreneurs to kind of sell them on something, snake oil, if you will, right? Or something that won't work. And at the same time, what ended up happening is they precluded these individuals from making investments. So therefore, the thought that the rich get richer, that is actually happening in the world we live in.
Yeah.
And so crowdfunding has changed that. It allows the ability for non-accredited to invest in companies through a Reg CF or a Reg A exemption. So that's the crowdfunding world, that maybe equity crowdfunding world that many understand today or are starting to see coming about. There's still a massive challenge in that world, and that is that there's a tremendous amount of work to select the startup. So Fundify is a registered funding portal with FINRA. We're regulated there, and we can transact execute these transactions. At the same time, however, though, the average American that wants to invest doesn't have the time to look at hundreds of startups and decipher which ones they want to invest in and then deploy their money in those particular ones, read all the data. And then on top of that, we just talked about having to invest in 50 or 100 companies to get the sort of returns that you'd like. That's what our new solution that we're going to be launching this really soon here in the next weeks to come is a solution. It's a subscription-based product where anyone can invest any amount of money. You can come in for a dollar. And for that dollar, we're going to take that, we're going to pool it with others, and we're going to source, negotiate terms with the best startups, deploy your capital on behalf of you, but in a group format. And then we're going to also use our Pro Advisor network to support those startups over time to help them be successful, all in to get you the returns that have been afforded to only the wealthy. So that's the future of where we see the evolution of where equity crowdfunding and investing is going.
There's so much to unpack there. So the ISQs, right? So traditionally, any of the fundraising that I've done, to your point, so it there's a ISQ investor suitability questionnaire. This is for the listeners who aren't familiar. And to give some perspective, so in Canada, our second biggest listening audience, your home counts toward your $1 million in that you would have to have in your net worth, which is great. In the United States, it doesn't. So if you have $1 million sitting in the bank, it can also be in investments and so forth. That counts. Then there's a minimum. I believe it's for a couple. It's 300,000 for an individual. It's 200,000. But then this is raw and real entrepreneurship. The reality is we're also seeing, to your point, mass layoffs. Just before we record this show, Citibank laid off 20,000 people. I just did a talk in Orlando for a group of entrepreneurs. We've got, it's estimated that 2.4 million jobs are going to be gone from generative AI alone. And the average income for those jobs is $90,000 for those individuals. And that's by 2030. So when you're talking and you're talking about that the rich get richer and that there isn't an opportunity to invest in these returns, 25, 28%, and that your team is going to say, vet the startups, put them in a basket that's kind of like an ETF, and then allow people to, you know, take extra money they have and to be able to invest. So will you put, like an ETF, will you put baskets, like will you put fintech in one and health tech in one and DEI startups in one? Like how is that going to work?
Eventually, we hope to offer those types of products, right? Initially, what we're going to do is we're going to find one startup for you this month that we think is great, that we've vetted and we've thoroughly looked through. and then invest your capital into that. Hopefully over time, we'll be able to invest your dollar into more than one startup, right? And then volume, then we would be able to do that, like where you could actually say, I really like fintech, so I'd like my money to be inside of fintech, or I want biotech, right? I'm going to invest, or maybe I want to invest overseas, and that's where I want to invest in women-led entrepreneurs. We could offer that. And but initially, without the volume, we have plenty of volume on the startup side that's starting to come in that we're reviewing and that we're looking at deal flow. At the same time, though, we're building into the volume to offer a full out ETF that where you can choose what subsections you might want to put your capital into.
I flipping love that. I love that. We were talking before we started the show and just about some statistics. So less than 2.5% of pitches by women get funded. So that's one, two VCs. Number two, less than 2% of US tech companies have at least one female founder. So I've been in that rarefied air for years. And then, you look at areas like AI, which is my area, and you have, very few female founders in that specific area. But then I was saying to Josh too, the statistics illustrate that over 60% women led startups are over 60% more profitable in their earlier years. And when you have a 90% failure rate, and that when you look at the data, and there's some amazing data out there, when you look at the data, it's really hard to quantify for some of it. Why? Like, is it because women are more resilient in the certain areas, like the emotional intelligence required? I don't know. Like, it is hard to quantify. New data is coming out, but to be able to offer that. So what are the minimum KPIs for startups who, you mentioned you've got the deal flow coming? Like, what kind of startups are you looking for?
We're looking for big ideas. We're looking for entrepreneurs that want to change the world and make big things happen. And so that's what we're looking for. At the same time, we're open to investing in great ideas that are already going. And of course, I think like many, we're open to very early stage. I've invested in companies. Some of my best investments have been ones where it's an idea on a napkin. And it's literally, okay, I'm going to build this. So then if that happens, will that be successful? So then the questions we're asking are, can this entrepreneur or the group of entrepreneurs, can they build this? And if they were to build it, do we think the world would adopt it? Now, the great news about making investments at that stage is that you're getting better valuations as an investor because there's less proof, right? You could also invest less. Often those companies, of course, are not raising $20 million, right? They're raising a few hundred thousand or a million or two to get things off of the ground. And so you can make smaller investments and earn and own a bigger piece of the company as an investor. That's not a bad way to go. At the same time, of course, we'd love to see some traction too, right? Where you see the traction and hopefully you're investing right at an inflection point where you see, oh, this company's seeing this type of revenue or customer adoption. And then they're also making some changes that we're now starting to see some of those changes come in, but the hockey stick isn't formed yet, right? So it looks much smaller, but you can see where the trajectory is going. Of course, those are really wonderful places to invest as well. And that's opportunistic investing. And so we love to invest that way too. And so those are the types of opportunities that we're going to be looking for. Now, what we'll do is we hope to be able to deploy capital very fast and be able to make decisions quickly, right? Whereas my experience has been that venture firms, they say they want to move quick, but they take an extraordinary amount of time. They lengthen things out. The lawyers stretch these things. And with later stage and larger amount investments, you can see why that might happen, why they might spend more time in due diligence, if you will. But we certainly have a diligence process that we work through, but we're at an earlier stage, there's less to diligence, right? Because you're getting started through the product. Mm-hmm.
Well, and to your point too, we saw the founders that I interviewed on the show and in my own experience, even last year, we were seeing longer diligence phases and then the VCs asking for more in diligence than they had ever asked for before. And then founders would go through months and months and months of diligence, whereas before it might be 2 weeks, and then only to find out, no, you're not getting funded, right? So that to to your credit. So what, so when a startup is looking to possibly come on the Fundify platform, what is the average length of time that your team is doing diligence before they get either, do you have a phased out process like early? Yeah. Yes. You would qualify for the next level or no, you don't? Like what does that time period look like for all of the founders listening?
Yeah, our process is still in the works, right? Meaning because we're launching our product next month. But as far as our historically and how we look at things is we try to communicate with founders very quickly. If they're open to filling out an application that would have more data, great, because that helps us put it in a form that that we can look at quicker and easier. At the same time, we're happy to look at a pitch deck and review that. And it might just add a day or two onto the time, right? But we're moving very quickly and our analysts will review that. And so we're moving fast and we want to make decisions fast. Being an entrepreneur myself, we don't want to string people along. I know that most of the time when someone says, hey, you know, something's not going well or whatnot, they really mean they're not going to invest, right? Or we'll talk next month, or I have something else going on. What they're saying is there's something else that's a higher priority than you, which means that doesn't look very sexy to them, right? Your company doesn't, and they just don't want to tell you that your baby's ugly. They think that, you know, and so therefore you're stuck in a circle and you're thinking and spending time as an entrepreneur, maybe we'll raise money from this group or maybe... I'd rather be transparent and actual and say, okay, well, this is what we're looking for. I'd love to keep in touch. We'd love to see you. And when you get this type of traction, or we're not really interested in this space, or I don't quite get it, right? Sometimes we might not see it. And entrepreneurs, of course, they're spending more time in their own businesses. But I think at the end of the day, we're trying to be really transparent and trying to move very quickly with entrepreneurs that come to us.
I love it. So people who are interested in investing or startup founders that are interested, because we're in sort of a pre-launch phase, you have like a way for them to get on a waiting list? Like how is that working?
Yeah. So Fundify is at waitlist only right now. So you can go to fundify.com and just give us your email address. You'll join the waitlist in order to, you know, become an investor, if you will. If you're a startup, we're already looking at startups now. If you also go to fundify.com, there's an area there where the startups can apply and say they're raising click on raise capital and start the process and the journey of taking a look at that with us. And we'll take a look at it with you.
Awesome. Well, Josh, thank you so much for being here. And I'm excited to invest on the platform. It's so fun. I do some other it's real estate, like the very sort of like a similar idea, like invest fractionally and, you know, and things and so forth. And then I do like the ISQ style investments too. And I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you, because I really feel in my work, in the developing world in Cambodia and Africa and even domestically in the US and Canada, there are a lot of amazing gritty founders who have great ideas and they have the determination and they're willing to do the work and they can be successful, but what you're building hasn't existed. And I think you're going to launch the next beautiful generation of entrepreneurs who are going to solve some of our biggest problems. So thank you for being exactly as you are. And I'm so grateful to have had this time with you.
Thank you, Susan, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, everyone, this is another episode of Raw and Real Entrepreneurship. Go to fundify.com, get on the list. And with that, whatever is going on in your life, I wish you the very best. God bless. Go rock your day. And I will see you in the next episode. Hey, this is Susan. And thanks so much for listening to this episode on Raw and Real Entrepreneurship. If this episode or any episode has been helpful to you, you've gotten at least one solid tip from myself or my guests, I would love it if you would leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. After you leave your review, go ahead and email reviews@susansly.com. Let us know where you left the review. And if I read your review on air, you could get a $50 Amazon gift card. And we would so appreciate it because reviews do help boost the show and get this message all over the world. If you're interested in any of the resources we discussed on the show, go to susansly.com. That's where all the show notes live. And with that, go out there, rock your day. God bless. And I will see you in the next episode. Are you currently an employee looking to start your own business? Maybe you've been thinking about it for a while and you're just not sure where to start. Well, my course, Employee to Entrepreneur, combines my decades of experience as an entrepreneur with proven methods, techniques, and skills to help you take that leap and start your own business. This course is self-paced, learn on demand, and comes with an incredible workbook. And that will allow you to go through this content piece by piece by piece, absorb it, take action, and then go on to the next module. So check out my course on susanslye.com, Employee to Entrepreneur.